I was a bit worried about how to pitch this before I came, and now I'm even more worried because the audience is a bit more diverse than I was expecting. So do stop me, as Christian said. You know, if you have questions about what I'm saying, or it's somewhere unclear, or I'm assuming too much, just tell me. I'm going to talk about improvisation in terms of interaction, in terms of the things that various people have worried about as being the mechanisms that structure interaction. So I'm going to argue, essentially, that improvisation has communicative structure and that there are important things we need to think about in the way that people manage the process of contributing and coordinating their contributions. That it's kind of fast and concurrent processing, and that the ways in which people normally try to explain this, I think, don't work because of essentially the novelty issue, actually, which came up in the last talk. So, a little bit of initial background. So, I recognise that this is a terrible image, but hopefully you can just about make it out. It's from Kendon's paper on the F formation, the facing formation, and it shows you the typical pose that we all just adopted, actually, outside for a conversation, where you stand, assuming there are no physical obstacles, you stand in a circle facing each other, and it has a certain special kind of organisation, this, although it kind of looks trivial. There are several distinct regions. So there's a thing called the O space, which is just the overlap space of the sort of bit that commands your attention. There's a P space, which is the periphery where you stand, and there's the R space. And people behave in very systematic ways around these things. So you don't walk through the middle of one of these. If we were standing in the corridor just now and people were having a conversation, if you're forced to go through the middle, you moderate it. You do a little, sorry. So that space has some sort of special virtual significance for the interaction. If you want to join, you don't just walk in. At least if you're socially competent, you don't walk in. You kind of hang off somebody's shoulder, and then when one of the people in the conversation acknowledges you, then you can enter. And when you're leaving, you don't just go straight that way. If you want to go that way, you go round. You step back, and you walk around. And so there's Kendon has a wonderful set of observations about this sort of thing. One other thing I'll mention is he also talks about the fact that this is a sort of plan view again. Different configurations have different significance. So this is this situation, and part of what that signifies is that I have unequal speaking rights because I'm the person in the head position. So that gives me, you know, a sort of recognised right to talk more than others. So one of the ways in which I have a parallel love to Michael is I got very interested some time ago in musical performance as a kind of interaction. So not the music, but the how people communicate and integrate their contributions, where the music might be thought of as being analogous to the speech in conversation. So we did a study in 2005, really, of free improvisation, where we got seven people who'd never played together before as a group. We video recorded them for about, 3 90-minute sessions of free improvisation. They were just allowed to do whatever they wanted. And then we did different things with this, and I'm only going to give you a very brief summary of what went on. But one of the things we were interested in was understanding what the participants themselves considered to be the moments where they were contributing or not. So we played the video back to them, asked them when they changed what they were doing, because it was just easier to get a reliable judgment out of them. This was a new idea. I introduced a new idea at this point. And then when they did that, when they changed what they were doing, who were they responding to, if anyone? Was it just theirs, or was it picking up on something else? And who, if anyone, responded to them? One of the first things I want to say is that the way they organized themselves in space echoed lots of things about an F formation, a face formation. So although we gave no instructions about how to position themselves, they formed a circle when they could. Obviously, instruments are an obstacle to this, right? If you've got a piano, you can't just sit anywhere or stand anywhere. But the people who could stand freely and who could move freely, the flautist and saxophonist and the violin, formed a circle. And you don't need to do that. I mean, in a sort of naive sense, if you're just listening to an instrument being played, you don't need to face each other. So there's the, you know, there's obviously something about the visual contact and the nonverbal behaviour. We saw joining and leaving processes. So people like the saxophonist, again, I'm sorry about the images, but the saxophonist, when not playing, would not be in the what corresponds to the P space. But if they were going to play something, they wouldn't just put the saxophone in their mouth. They would step to the periphery, then put the saxophone in their mouth, then play, and so, and if they were reversing out, they would do the opposite. So there are sort of entry and exit procedures, very, you know, identical in many ways to the ones in conversation, that allow you to understand who's going to do what and when, what comes next. There was also a sense that the O space was respected, just like the example I used for conversations in the corridor, which was that people would sometimes cross the circle to, I don't know, plug in an amplifier or something, but they wouldn't play ordinarily in the middle. That would be a very kind of marked thing to do. And they would also, you know, duck as they went through the middle. There was one instance of a player moving to the middle. It was the saxophonist. They did it just after they'd gestured a lot to try and engage another player. Then they walked into the middle, started playing, and everyone else dropped out. And it was awkward. the other players clearly didn't like it. So the point of all, so that's like a head position. It's a bit like this one. We then sort of, in a very informal way, mapped out what was happening with the ideas as they reported themselves. So each musician had told us when they thought they did something new or not. So that's the sort of dense colour bars. So at that point, the piano's introduced an idea. At this point, the flute's introduced an idea. At this point, the violin... is it? No, the trumpet's introduced an idea.
So this is self-perception of, I think I introduced it.
Exactly, yeah. So this is what, this is our map of what each of them said separately. So we took them individually to look at the video. Each of them said separately when they were responding to somebody else, when they were producing something new. I mean, from our point of view, what was interesting about this is that, of course there is parallel activity. People are doing things in parallel. But actually, the introduction of ideas is largely sequential. And in fact, I mean, really strikingly sequential at this point. So the new idea and the supporting responses all happen absolutely simultaneously. And the persistence of the ideas, I mean, I should point out this is observational work, so we didn't support these conclusions with quantitative study, but the persistence seemed to depend on uptake by others. So there's a sort of a cut-off. The piano tries something, one person, the percussion takes it up for a moment, and then everyone drops it. Similarly with the violin. So persistence seems to depend on everyone else following up. How did I mess this up? Right. So we took each person separately, showed them the video, asked them to tell us when they did something different, when they changed what they were playing, whether it was in response to anyone else, if it was, and I've forgotten the third thing we asked them. But we're asking the musicians themselves to tell us what they thought was going on. And so, that's partly the interest, right? They did it independently, but they produced something which is clearly very orderly and that they all agree on independently was very orderly. This just maps the sort of... The violin had a sort of lead role in what was going on, but there was lots of different people taking up of each other's ideas. So it's fairly distributed and open interaction. So free improvisation is like conversation. That was our sort of interpretation of what was going on here. But the things that we normally observe commonly in face-to-face interaction were being reproduced in this face-to-face musical interaction. There's a relatively orderly, I mean, it's not perfect, a bit messy, but relatively orderly rapid turnover of musical ideas. introduced sequentially, adopted through parallel uptake. And the position in space, the face formation, appears to provide a key resource for doing that. Not the only resource. We have been involved in other studies where, and actually you've done these studies as well, haven't you? Where you put a screen in between people and then see if they can still coordinate. And of course they can, but there are different resources at work. They're using different cues. So the facing stuff provides an understanding of what's going on, anticipating what will come next, and displaying your responsiveness to what comes next. And conversation is like free improvisation. So this works two ways. And I don't know if this is trivial. I mean, I know that Michael knows all of this, but I don't know who else in the room knows this or not. But there is a sort of model of conversation where it's serial. You know, I say something, you say something, I say something, you say something. But there's a lot of psycholinguistics which says that's not true. That's not what's really going on. Back channels where you nod or grunt or as people are talking, thank you, perfect. Gaze and attention. Goodwin wrote a really wonderful paper in 1979 about starting a sentence at a dinner party, which you have to look away, Saul, to make this work. So starting a sentence at a dinner party to somebody who's not paying attention, and then you shift mid-sentence to somebody else. But it's still not, and then you have to shift to somebody else because it's the news item for them in the last clause. And the point is, there's this interactive seeking of response during the production of the utterance, right? Content-specific feedback, Janet Bavalas talks about a lot, how you have to raise your eyebrows at the right moment. It's fantastic. You did it perfectly. Thank you. Storytellers need the appropriate content-specific feedback from their addressee at the right times. If they don't get it, their story falls apart. And then there's really obvious cases like split utterances. We did some work on where the actual turn itself is actually literally produced by two people with appropriate substitutions. I'm afraid I burnt the kitchen ceiling, but have you burnt myself? There's a sort of interesting substitution there. But it's all, in a sense, one turn produced by two people. Fortunately not. So all of that's a long-winded way of saying in conversation, there is a sort of parallel thing going on, just like a musical ensemble performance, where it really matters what the other people are doing simultaneously to your production. So how do we interact? It becomes a question. How do we do that, and how do we do it quickly? Because it's happening in real time, as you were pointing out earlier. So this is all nicely set up for me, so I don't need to say too much, and in fact, this is not my area. So I can't say much. But one of the ways in which people have tried to model this is to think about neuropsychological models of action perception, where there is... So this is Pickering and Garrod's 2013 paper, where they talked about the fact that in action perception... action production, I should say. When somebody wants to do something, they have this neural route, which is about, you know, I've got to pick up the cup, I need to plan to pick up the cup, move my hand and so on. And then there's a parallel route called the afferent copy, which is predicting the perceptual results of picking up the cup. So you've got these two routes. You want to do something, you're planning how to actually execute it, and at the same time you've got an expectation really quickly of what it should look like when you've done that. So you can, I think in this literature the general idea is then you could correct, for example. What Pickering and Garrod did was generalize this to conversation. So this is an individual person doing something and predicting the effects of their doing and then matching them up. They generalize this to conversation in which they have a speaker and addressee. So somebody, person B, is speaking, they're producing their utterance in time. It starts here and carries on and they finish their utterance there. And at the same time, the addressee is trying to predict, on the evidence of what they've heard so far, what the full utterance will look like. So they use the fact that there's a couple of words have happened in a certain context to try to, in advance, guess what the final utterance will be. And it's a bit like the mirroring story about how you can rapidly comprehend and produce language and conversation. Now, I I have to confess I've got a big problem with this. not because I think these models are wrong. I think that they model the wrong behaviour. So I don't think conversation looks like you might expect if you took this to be an account of successful dialogue. So the reason I'm saying that is that I think, and I think it actually came out in the previous talk, this can work for things that you already know. It's essentially a conservative model, and there's a history of these conservative models, priming models, input-output coordination in dialogue. All of those models work for things where you already know what's going to be said in some way. And they and that isn't really consistent with what you see, at least in ordinary dialogue. So in task-oriented dialogues, you get lots of repetition, and you get a situation which is somewhat similar to, or at least very constrained samples of language. In free dialogue, 95% of words are not repeated, and you really have to repeat some words. I have to repeat the and a if I'm using English. Right. So if it's a very crude count of the number of words that are repeated across pairs of turns in free dialogue, almost none of them are. So the thing that you have just processed and the thing that you have predicted as being the scaffolding for your turn is actually going to interfere with the novelty of the turns you actually produce. And it's even worse for syntactic structure, at least I would claim. This is controversial, but Healy Perva Howe's claim, people systematically diverge in their choice of syntactic structures. So what that means is that if I use a particular grammatical construction in my turn, you are less likely than chance to use the same one in the next turn, which is a real problem, right? If what you've got mainly is differences, that's the bit you need to explain. That's the behaviours you need to explain. These are the orbits of the planets that need to be captured. And we've done a similar kind of analysis on posture where we've looked at, with Nicola Plant, this is her PhD work, we've looked at fitting motion capture skeletons to people during conversation. I'll show you an example of the conversation next. And we've mapped how similar their posture is. And essentially, the more engaged they are in the dialogue, the less similar their posture becomes. So if they're standing like this, not talking, that's the point of maximum posture similarity. And as they start to talk, as they start to gesture, the more that both of them gesture, the more they talk over each other, the less similar they become. These are ordinary dialogues. So, again, that's a lot. You know, all that really amounts to is saying, well, actually, most of what happens in free conversation is different, is some, in some sense improvised, and I'll try and explore that a bit. So here's an example that's close to my heart because I've got an abscess and I had to go to the dentist 2 days ago and I'm full of antibiotics, the most I've ever had. So it's just taken from Nicola Plant's corpus, and it's a woman A describing to person B something about a dental operation. So A says, and they took a bit of my bone away, also in the process because it was so like crook, crook. B says, what did they put there instead? A didn't put anything. It was huge. It was a big hole. It was, what's there now, huh? What's in your mouth now? There's nothing. I have like this piece of gum. That's that, you know, it's sort of gum back together. Now, there's a few things I want to say about this. But this is what I mean by free conversation, right? There's no, it's not task-oriented. You're not being restricted in your responses. You can just say whatever you like. It's people telling stories to each other about stuff that happened to them that had some significance in their lives. One of the kind of the sort of initially really obvious things is they're using ad hoc meanings. There's no, you can't look up crook crook in a dictionary. It's not anything probably you've heard before specifically, but it makes sense in context. You get something about the sense of what's going on. So there's this sort of ambiguity and underspecification going on. And Michael's supervisor wrote a paper on that nonsense years ago. So there's also the negotiation of the meaning of a turn. What's there now, huh? What's in your mouth now? A is having real trouble with this, with B's stuff, right? Can't quite understand why she hasn't already answered B, actually. it's a big hole. What's there now? It's a big hole. So there's the negotiated meaning. It's the sort of novel meanings. There's a negotiation of what is being actually said and what the kind of turn is and so on that's going on all the time. And it's also concurrent with simultaneously non-verbal behaviour and feedback. So now you know where the bone came from, right? Where the tooth was. It wasn't in the dialogue as I transcribed it, but it's clear from this. Because it was so like, and then crook, you're getting a bit more, right? There's a sort of pressure, I guess, involved in the what was going on. What did they put there instead? Didn't put anything. Actually, on a video, this is didn't put anything. It's like, really? Come on. Didn't put anything. I've already told you. It was huge. It was a big hole. The hands go back up. Actually, one of the things that speakers normally do is they keep, they drop their hands. So, listeners shouldn't gesture in general. If you gesture, that's kind of bad. It looks like you're trying to speak. It's okay to nod and stuff, but moving your hands around is bad. So when A gets interrupted, the gesture gets paused or sometimes dropped. So there's all that kind of simultaneous concurrent movement. Then B's question comes again. The gesture gets kind of, that gets dropped to this. What's in your mouth now? There's nothing I have like this piece of gum that's, you know, sort of gummed back together. I think she's having trouble there because she's realised that gum and gummed are sort of confusable. So, there is lots of mess, right? That's one way of putting it, but systematic mess. There's lots of clarification, lots of repair, lots of reformulation. There's very little that works in this conversation first time. And actually, we have done studies where we've tried to quantify, so provide a coding scheme for looking at these kind of phenomena, repair, self-repair, where you're repeating words or where you're switching words, clarification questions, which are directed at, you know, understanding the prior turn. All of this, about a third of turns in ordinary dialogue involve something like this. It's about half this dialogue probably. About a third of, when you count it, it's about a third of dialogue. So there's an awful lot of what goes on in dialogue, which is essentially a response to the unpredictable and improvised things you need to do. Because you need to make up stuff as you go along in collaboration with the other person. And there's also evidence that this is a true of all languages. So there is a recent paper in PLOS One by Dingemans, which looked at this particular form of open-initiated repair, clarification question, and there's a very similar format and a very is similar in a variety of ways across a wide variety of languages. So it seems like it's a universal. It seems like a universal feature of human interaction. It seems like this is where a lot of work is getting done, but it's not being done because. But it's not being done by mechanisms that can predict what's happening next. Because this is not about, your predictions are wrong in all of these cases. So, I got to my conclusion. Before, I've still got lots of time, shall I slow down? So, part of the point of this was that musical and verbal performances are joint interactions with active simultaneous engagement by all parties. I don't know if that's even remotely controversial in this room. It's probably not. Joint improvisation is necessary to respond constructively to unexpected contributions and interactions. So what I showed you was an illustration for a one dialogue, but I think in general, there's an awful lot of what goes on in interaction is essentially unpredictable, and so that you need to have mechanisms for dealing with that. And there are quite rich, quite systematic mechanisms. So conversation analysts, maybe Saul's going to talk about this, I don't know, have mapped a quite elaborate structure for dealing with those unexpected events, which seems to be pervasive in all conversations. So that in conversation seems to be, the key processes seem to be clarification and repair, and they seem to be unavoidable, except in conversations where you just don't care. But in, and these also appear to be tightly associated with our ability to generate new conventions. I haven't shown any of that evidence, but we've done experiments on both graphical and linguistic, the evolution of graphical and linguistic conventions, and these seem to be the essential processes. Not repetition, not simply exposure to the materials, but the ability to do clarification and repair, which is intrinsically a joint activity. Which, if that's right, and I don't know if this is true of music, I've never been able to just get that far. whether there are analogous structures in music, I presume if there were, they would be more evident during rehearsal than performance. Maybe. If that's right, then meaning, and this is the more important point for me, the semantics is constitutively a jointly improvised product of interaction. So it's not that we know in advance what we or others mean by what we say. It's something that we have to negotiate through the process of interaction using these mechanisms. And that's it. Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you. I have a question about the joint, the group of musicians free improvising. What did you, could only one person play at the same time, or could they all play?
They were all playing, well, not all the time, but yes, no, they could definitely all play at the same time, and they usually were.
Okay, so, okay. Because I was wondering.
I don't know how I managed to. I really made a mess of explaining this.
No,
didn't I?
No, no,
we make meaning together.
So that the blocks represent times when people were playing. So if you see,
So my question is specifically: so you had this spatial arrangement where there were different, there was meaning to where they were physically standing. But did you notice any patterns with across the different types of instruments where something like percussion or bass has it occupies a certain space musically depending on its physical characteristics or the octave?
You're just asking the wrong person because I'm just ignorant about music. But I guess they definitely were constrained musically. So if you've got percussion.
Yeah, so I'm just interested in the interaction between the roles that are already defined by, like, just traditions in musical performance how you arrange them, and that's maybe that changed it, or how those two things interacted.
No. Again, I've obviously missed one of the key points. We didn't arrange them in space at all. They arranged themselves in space, and that was important.
Oh.
It was the observation that they formed a circle that initially made us think, oh, but that's weirdly quite like...
Oh, cool.
Quite like conversation. And naively, I assumed, at the time, you didn't need to do that because you can hear. So you could actually have your back to somebody, surely, and improvise fine. But that turned out to be not... For this group, that turned out to be not the case. You can put a screen in between people and they can still do it, but they do it differently.
Oh, okay, cool. Awesome. Thank you.
Sorry.
Yeah, just a quick question in relation to that. For how long were they playing, and for how many days was this repeated? Or was this only
one? It was three 90-minute sessions.
Sorry?
It was three 90-minute sessions.
Okay.
And I honestly can't remember how... I think it was over a week or maybe 2 weeks. They definitely went away and came back on different days. I don't remember.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Beautiful. One thing you said about not crossing the O space or the zero space in the center, you said if you're socially competent, I'd like to add that it's also culturally conditioned. You know, anthropologists have dealt with that. E.T. Hall in the 70s wrote about different sense of space and in a different book of time in different cultures. So I was wondering if the cultural background of the improvisers in conversation or in a music set jam, you know, if they're coming from very different cultural backgrounds, what would happen then?
Well, I don't know, right?
Okay, so just the
because
thought.
We only did one.
Yeah. And yeah.
Well, I think you're right. The stuff that I know about is mainly to do with interpersonal distance and eye contact, mm-hmm. varying culturally. But I've not seen, I mean, if you know of a paper about this formation and whether that varies, I'd be quite...
Yeah, the book, because I was reading the book when I was new in the United States, and I was impressed by people, you know, crossing my space between me and the shelf and the supermarket, but leaving plenty of space. Now, in Israel, they would push me, think it's part of their space as much as mine, and would not bother about it.
And that's different.
In the States, they would say, excuse me, although they didn't never touch me. So it's a different, you know, cultural conditioning of a sense of space, and that's what brought me to think about it.
I think that's right. Mm-hmm. What I don't know is whether the social space rules are the same. So individual space, yeah, definitely. The proximity and your willingness to barge people and walk across in front of people in galleries, that particularly annoys me. Is that those are different conditions from this one, right?
And because you're Anglo-Saxon, that's why it bugs you, you know? That's the point. And another thing, something else, you said that the responder doesn't gesture. And I've, you know, in a conversation, that if the respond, if I got you correctly.
The listener.
I said the responder, yeah. I'm sorry. I meant the listener, yes, thanks. That the listener doesn't gesture, because if the listener gestures, then it's like asking for the right to speak, or an intention, expressed intention to participate. My observation, which is not scientific, is that the responder often, that the listener often responds, and that the response is often intriguing. Because sometimes when you hear a terrible story that you're telling me, and I would say, you know, put my hand on my mouth in order to express sympathy or horror, or if you describe a very ugly person that you just met and I just, you know, I interpret your, you know, it as a sign of sympathy or participation or something
yeah.
like that.
So again, I wasn't sufficiently careful, and there are some interesting counterexamples. So, the work of Bavlas, which I mentioned in passing, is the facial work, is the face stuff. You've got to do the right faces if you're being looked at. If you're not being looked at, you don't do the faces. It's not automatic. Right, but if you're being looked at, you have to pull the right faces at the right moments, raise your eyebrows, nod, all of that stuff. It's the hands. You should keep the hands still. If you start moving the hands, that ordinarily seems like a bid for the floor. Ordinarily, right? So, I mean, people do this in meetings, right?
Oh, yeah.
That means they want to talk.
If it's related.
But if it's related, and we just did a study in particular, because we're interested in repair, what happens to the listener's hands when the speaker gets into trouble. So the speaker starts searching for a word or hesitating or something, then the listener's hands start moving. And they both move their hands. And that seems to be a perfect moment at which you can both actively engage to try to get the utterance finished somehow. So there are definitely special cases. I mean, absolutely.
Thank you very much. I had a question about the gummy gum interaction. But in a more general one to do that with that, with the, you saying that there's lots of repair that goes on and lots of querying. So I'm wondering if you've done any work on how people talk about what they were thinking about while they were having that conversation. So how frustrating or not it is, and whether it has any long-term effect, and has any people looking at that kind of thing.
We've actually done experiments with a chat tool where we cause trouble. We stick clarification questions into a dialogue as though they've come from the other person, and then look at what happens. It's a long story, but if you do it the right way, it improves the semantic the meaning coordination at the end of the dialogue. So if you cause a little bit of trouble at the right moments, in a certain sense, the dialogue goes much better.
Right.
But if you just randomly scatter clarification questions into a dialogue, that's really bad. Really bad.
That makes
sense. Because it seems like you're not trying, right? It seems like you're not actually...
Yeah, I guess I'm interested in how people are actually then
thinking about that. Yeah, I didn't get back... So normally, when we're doing this with a chat tool, we get away with it. People don't notice there's any manipulation. But if there's a little bit too much or they're in odd places, then people do notice and they get cross. Right. And they get cross with their partner.
Right.
The reaction is a kind of moral irritation, sometimes outrage. Like, why are you being so stupid about this?
And do you think that then, in the end, there's actually clarity, so the point of the conversation has become clear and they're all in agreement, then has that indignation melted away and are they now best friends? Or does it tend to stay as, like,
I don't know.
This is a bad partner?
I don't know. So Putnam talks about the principle of charitable interpretation, right? Where in ordinary interaction, we don't, you know, it's a really quite bizarre thing to start asking people what they mean. There's a great Garfinkel experiment on this as well. Right? You don't normally do that. You normally think, well, I didn't quite get that, but I'll just let it go, and let's see if we're all right. So there's this sort of strong presumption that you'll try to get what you can from the conversation. And if you break that contract, then you get these sort of socially difficult moments. but whether afterwards, you know, it's all resolved, I don't know. I think it leaves a lingering irritation, actually.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Very interesting talk. I just would ask you to comment a little bit more about the very, very last point that you made, that the meaning in conversation is actually not... in the kind of aligning of pre-existing mind states or something, but it's kind of generated on the fly. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because it's kind of based on what you just said about people kind of trying to understand each other, it kind of usually is explained as people trying to align their mental states.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I'm complaining about. So there's a tradition in cognitive psychology and cognitive science more generally, which is a sort of, I think it's inherited from certain sort of logical models of semantics, which is that communicative success consists in my representation in my brain aligning exactly with your representation in your brain. For different reasons, would say that just never happens. Right, there's always residual ambiguity. It could never be the same. There's no way that we could ever have internalized the representational vocabulary necessary as a precondition for that. So actually, what we're always doing in interaction is coping with the possibility of difference. And so it's a sort of... If you stop thinking of communicative success as the alignment of representational states, and you start thinking of it as the use of the processes by which you negotiate difference. And you can never ultimately be sure that you have resolved, you know, there's no sort of perfect state. There's just, did you get by for the interaction? You know, did you actually, if I asked you to pick up a cup, did you actually pick up the thing that I wanted you to? It doesn't matter if we don't mean the same thing by cup. So there are other ways of introducing criteria for sameness of meaning, right? So it's about identity criteria on meaning. So when did we mean the same thing? That becomes a question about what happened in the interaction, not about individual cognitive states. And I think that actually connects to a sort of a certain tradition in philosophy of language, which is essentially that meaning is constitutively a public thing. It's not, it cannot be a matter of individual brain states. It's a very long-winded...
That was good, thanks. I'm just kind of, is that link, or I suppose that is linked to the free conversation not having as strict or clearly defined goals as you might have in many experiments.
No,
is that
actually.
Not at all.
So, okay. So am I allowed to answer, Michael? You're looking...
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So even in very, very constrained task-oriented dialogue, so I did a lot of work on the maze task, I don't know if you've ever come across this, but you have to refer to, you get a grid in front of you, both of you get a grid in front of you, and you have to tell each other where a box is and where a marker is in a box, right? Even in that incredibly restricted situation, people mean different things by box and square and row, right? Really simple, low-level... I find it hard to imagine more basic words of English, right? But they just, in pressed into use in new contexts, it all falls apart. You've got to reconstruct what box means, or what square means, or what row means, or diagonal, or column. So actually, I think, that's where I started from. I saw these differences in those restricted task-oriented dialogues, and of course it's much worse in a free dialogue. So,
thanks very much.
Yeah. I had the same question, so maybe...
Exactly the same.
I'm wondering, thank you very much for this talk. Have there been any studies that have been done comparing a conversation or a dialogue between two strangers versus between people who know each other that are talking about an event that one of them doesn't know, just to show the difference in effort that's made to communicate towards a stranger versus someone you know?
Difference in effort. So there's lots of studies like that. John Morton did a really interesting one on people recalling events. He took partners who'd been to a party together away and got them to tell him what happened, and they had really divergent accounts in many ways. Simon Garrod did a really good study, which I don't think he ever published, actually, but he found that if you got people in the lab and asked them to arrange to meet somewhere, and then took them separately and got them to point on a map where it was 20% of the time different, right? So there are these situations where, and these were, in the Morton case, a couple who'd been to the same party, so the presumption was they would have the same memory trace. I think that's the wrong presumption. In the Garrod case, I don't think he was manipulating familiarity, actually. So I sort of half know the answer, only half know. Michael may know more. He was nodding.
So in my lab, we tried to do a systematic study using referential communication tasks that have been used in labs where you can really measure the extent to which people's using the same words to mean the same things. And we selected married couples and strangers of the same age and sort of matched them either with their partner or with somebody else. And we had people who were recently married, had been together 20 years, had been together 40 years to try to really sort of tease this apart, and found massive age differences in how people do the alignment and how long it takes them to reach agreement and understanding, with older people being slower. We could not find, try as we might, any difference between the married couples and the strangers in the success and accuracy of communication. We had anticipated by all sorts of theories that people who've been together a long time should be able to skirt the need, have private keys that lead them right where they're going, and we could not find a thing.